This episode of Office 365 Exposed is brought to you by eNow Software, the leader in Office 365 monitoring and reporting software with the only fully integrated monitoring and reporting solution for Office 365, Exchange, SharePoint, Skype, and Active Directory. For more information, visit eNowSoftware.com.
Welcome to a special edition of Office 365 Exposed, your favorite podcast featuring me, Paul Robichaux, and my compatriot and companion, Tony Redmond. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Paul.
We're recording this in the headquarters of eNow in Aliso Viejo, California, which I think is the first time that we've had an opportunity to do a podcast from California, so yay for us. Normally we do these at conferences, and we haven't had a conference lately, and there's still a lot going on to talk about, thus a special edition.
Indeed. It's actually nice to be in California, despite the fact that I'm just a little bit jet-lagged, but sic transit gloria mundi, as they say. So
exactly.
The Romans said, anyway.
You'll get over that just in time to go home.
Yes, indeed.
So we've got a lot to talk about today. You know, Microsoft is continuing to do lots of interesting things around Office 365 and around their on-prem products. There are interesting things happening in the market. There's a U.S. presidential election going on that I really don't want to talk about. And with that said, probably should get started.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in the on-prem space. Because I guess one of the things that people often worry about, in fact, that with the rush to the cloud or, you know, the movement, and there is a steady movement of workload to the cloud, that the on-prem space, nothing will happen. It'll become stagnant, a pool of nothing. Is that fair?
It's a fair thing to be worried about, because Microsoft at Ignite, in fact, when we recorded a previous edition, I got the opportunity to talk to Microsoft's Brent Allinger about the servicing model for Exchange 2016 going forward, and he was very careful to emphasize that Microsoft is going to hit a steady cadence of predictable releases for Exchange 2016, just as they have for Exchange 2013 and even back into the Exchange 2010 days. But you're right that it doesn't seem like a lot has been happening in that market space. Things have been fairly quiet from Redmond. We haven't seen a lot of talk about when CU1 will be available or what will be in
it. That's CU1 for Exchange 2016.
Yes, for Exchange 2016, right? I tend to forget that, of course, we also have CU12 for Exchange 2013, which is a vastly different animal. There's been a lot of chatter around that.
Right.
Related to something called mailbox anchoring that I think some people may have heard of, but others may not. Maybe you can summarize real quickly for the people who aren't familiar with what's going on there.
Well, essentially, what happened is that Microsoft decided that they wanted to make sure that when you started off a remote PowerShell session to do some Exchange administration, which is all very good, what they would do is that they would anchor that session to a mailbox, because you really need to connect to a mailbox to do an administration, and that mailbox would be on a server that was running the highest available version of Exchange within your organization.
That seems like a reasonable thing to do.
It absolutely makes a ton of sense. It really makes a ton of sense in certain circumstances, such as if you're running a massive multi-tenant organization for Exchange. Absolutely. So in Office 365, where there is very strict control over versions, and basically you've got new versions going out all the time, and those new versions are really new versions. I mean, you don't end up with a situation where you have a lot of old servers sitting around Office 365. Now, interestingly enough, and if you talk to some of the guys who have to run Office 365, they will admit that they have stragglers. I mean, it's the nature of the beast.
Well, sure, with as many servers as they have, inevitably there will be a few that...
When they have 100,000 servers, they will end up with some that are stragglers. And by this, I mean an Exchange server that is running a version of the software that is behind the curve, is behind what Microsoft intend all of the servers to do. But anyway, so the design change which Microsoft went through and announced that they were going to implement in Exchange 2016 and Exchange 2013 and indeed they did. They went ahead and did it in CU11. Was as good a design change as you can make for an environment like that. But unfortunately, as soon as CU11 went out, bang, people started, administrators, and Andrew Higginbotham did an extremely fine job. Well, it's the kind of thing he does, you know, when working for Dell Global Support. He did an extremely fine job at documenting all the issues. Basically, people would start off remote PowerShell, try and connect, and bang, it didn't work. And it was really, really, really bad. So what Microsoft said, you know what, this isn't going to work for us out in the field, because there are so many different moving parts out in the field that nobody has any control of. I mean, there are some very weird and wonderful ways of deploying Exchange that occur in on-premises deployments that would never happen. They wouldn't comply with Microsoft's preferred architecture. They don't comply with best practice. They're just done because they work, and that's what's happened. So what people don't want to have is that they come to upgrade part of their infrastructure and find it falls down, and that was essentially what's happened.
So, and this, we should point out, it wasn't configurable, it wasn't optional. It just was a change that was included in these releases, and immediately you deployed those releases, you were subject to the change whether you wanted to opt in or not.
Right.
So one question I had after that whole situation came to light, would it have made any difference if Microsoft had said ahead of time, this is what we're going to do, and here's why? Do you think that would have changed the impact to customers? Would it have given customers an opportunity to say, wait, this will break it? Or was it something that people wouldn't have understood the impact of until they
saw it deployed? I think to be fair to Microsoft, most people just wouldn't have understood what was happening. There was some background conversations going on, and certainly some of the MVPs stood up and said, you know what, this doesn't seem like a great idea. You know, we've sniffed at it, we've thought about it, and it doesn't seem like a great idea. But I think it would also be fair to say that there was no compelling case constructed where you could say, you know what, this is absolutely going to be a horrible idea. So it was reasonable for Microsoft to say, you know what, we've taken your advice on board. We think this is the right thing to do. We think we've taken all the mitigation steps to make sure that it's going to work in practice. So we're going to make this change. And so they did in Exchange 2013 CU11. But as I've said before, once CU11 went out, very quickly thereafter, there were all sorts of problems. And you know, you just have to go and look at Andrew's post from July 6th, or January 6th, and you find out some of the different issues. So they've gone back. Anyway, they've reverted. And there will be no change made in Exchange 2016 CU1, and there will be they will revert to previous behavior when CU12 for Exchange 2013 goes out the door, which is good. But they're still saying, I think this is fair to say, they're still saying, you know what, we still think that it's a good thing for you to go and connect to a server that's running the highest possible version of Exchange. And the reason why I think that's a reasonable stance to take is that if you connect to an older server, it has no chance in hell of knowing about any new stuff.
Exactly. We've seen this pattern before, right? Constant pattern is you connect to the latest version of CAS or unified messaging or other endpoints, and those roles are able to proxy down, but in general, you can't count on being able to proxy.
New stuff knows about old stuff. Right. Old stuff can never know about new
stuff. So, from that standpoint, it's perfectly fair to have that requirement.
Right.
It's interesting to see Microsoft, in a way, I think they're a little bit caught in their own trap. One of the key things that the Exchange team has done well in advance of the other product groups who contribute to Office 365 is they've been able to unify their code base and run essentially the same code in the service that they do on-prem.
Yep.
So when they make a change that benefits the service and is necessary for the service, given the service's scale, they also are now subject to the fact that that may be bad or disastrous even for their on-prem customers. And it sounds like from what you said that the on-prem customers may not have recognized the magnitude of that change in time to do anything about it, even if they had known.
I mean, even if Microsoft had come out and written chapter and verse, and they did. They did put out an ELO blog post about it. But even if they had come out with such a lot more information, people possibly would not have twigged what was going on and what would the consequences, what would flow from this decision. What is accurate, I think, to say is that perhaps Microsoft fell down here on testing. I think they did.
Well, except it sounds like the feature does exactly what it was supposed to. So from that standpoint, right. their test procedures did what they should. But it sounds like they maybe didn't anticipate the breadth or the number of different customer environments that this fix would be deployed in, and they didn't anticipate that some of those would have problems.
Yeah, okay. So when you read through some of the reports that came in, okay, such as if you go and deploy Exchange 2013 CU11 into an existing Exchange 2010 environment, and this is the first version of Exchange 2013.
Okay? Which is reasonable if you've been on 2010 and you decide you want to upgrade.
Right. And after that installation happens, you know, everything goes ahead, hunky-dory. You've now got a brand new Exchange 2013 server running CU11 in that environment. But once that installation happens, an Exchange admin is going to be unable to use the Exchange management shell. They're not going to be able to make a remote PowerShell session to 2013, which means then that you can't manage any objects that are specific to Exchange 2013. Any of those that have been stamped and said, you know what, I need 2013 to manage me. And also, you may not be able to actually use the Exchange Admin Center, EAC.
Well, it depends on the shell.
Depends on the shell. So, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I would have thought that one of the basic tests that you're going to do, is bringing a new version of Exchange into a 2010 organization.
Sure.
Okay. I
would expect that as well.
I think that was a testing problem. I think that, that absolutely was a testing issue, and I think they got that wrong. I really do think that they got that wrong. I think the intention behind the change was admirable. I think it was right. The logic you can't fault it by saying go and connect to the highest version of Exchange. You cannot fault that logic. But the testing failed.
It's a great illustration of one of the reasons why Microsoft is so committed to Office 365 as a service is because they control the variables. They control how software is deployed. They control the environment into which it's deployed, and it's predictable for them. So with that said, maybe now is a good time to start talking about some of the things that have changed.
Well, before we go to the service, let me say one thing. I think Ross Smith outlined a number of solutions, a number of recommendations, if you will, for going forward. And I think that there's some good advice here. And the one piece, the one thing I would say to Exchange admins in this case is think about how your remote sessions are actually connected, and perhaps always choose a server. You can specify a server name when you want to connect.
Right.
Choose a server that you know is running the highest version in your organization. That's the easiest way of getting around this problem now and in the future. And if you do that rather than just say, have any old server, I think you can't go far wrong. But going forward, let's go talk about Office 365 and Exchange Online and all that good stuff. A new admin center. Starting on March the 3rd, Microsoft started to roll out this new center, a new flash. Now, it's been in preview for a while.
Right.
Okay. And I was interested to read on Yammer.
On Yammer, did you say?
Oh, yes. Yes, I actually...
All right, so everyone in the audience, when we say Yammer, you have to drink. That's the rule.
Yeah. Well, so here's another mention of Yammer. I actually like the Office 365 IT network that runs on Yammer.
It's grown quite a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's well over 80,000 people now subscribe to this network. And you know what? I think it shows Yammer being used correctly.
So I agree. Definitely an appropriate use.
So what I liked, what I found interesting was that Anne Michaels of Microsoft made a note or posted on Yammer to say that, you know what, the dev team reached a milestone where the functionality used by a large portion of the existing customer base is is available in the new portal. So in other words, that they had started off in preview and there wasn't so many of the things that actually worked. So many of the options actually worked. But now they reached a stage, well, you know what? We've got to a milestone in our development process where most of the functionality works. And so she said, based on the milestone and due to very positive feedback from their preview customers, we're rolling out the new portal as a default experience. So what this means is if you go to portal.office.com, you're going to see the new experience in quotes,
right,
rather than the old version. Now, she went on to acknowledge that there are specific scenarios that are needed but are not yet available in the new portal. So in other words, not everything works.
Right.
Okay. But again, she went on to say that they're working on getting to feature parity and expect to achieve it in a few weeks. So that's what's happening. Basically, we've got a new flashy, jazzy, all singing, all dancing, highly colorful admin portal. And you know what? I think that's fine as it goes. In fact, I think it's a sign of some unification work that Microsoft is doing around the universal app that's available on Windows Phone and is in beta the app is available, of course, on iOS and Android as well. How could I have missed that? But it's now in beta for universal app on Windows 10. And you can see a lot of the design elements that they're now using in the new portal in those apps. So what you can see here is, I think, is a coalescing of the towards a single admin experience, if you will, on these multiple apps.
Does it strike you as a little bit retro that we've gone from a world where we used to have apps to manage services like Exchange or like Link to a world where those services all have web-based consoles, back to a world now where you have an app that you download to manage?
Yeah, well, I mean, the apps, you know, I don't get that excited about them. I think they're kind of nice, and once in a while I will use them. So that's just
they're fine. Useful on the go when all you have is a phone.
Yeah, when all useful. Yeah, they are, yeah, absolutely. And to give Microsoft credit here again, Matt Lopez and the team, he's the PM in charge of the mobile app. They've been pretty good about pushing out updates. I mean, they push out updates very quickly, and they're very responsive to user feedback.
Although, Matt, if you're listening, one feature request: I already have the app. You've seen me log into the service using the app, so you can stop asking me if I'd like to download it now.
Yeah, they are pretty insistent. They're becoming like spammers or whatever, or people who want to sell you credit cards or give you new credit cards. But to come back to the app that they have now made, or the interface that they've now made the default portal, I don't have any heartburn at all about them switching. You know, that's all fine. It's just UI, and you get used to UI. I've heard a lot of commentary from people who are experienced admins that it's slower, it's buggier, and it's, of course, missing functionality. I guess those things will be addressed over time. And anyway, experienced admins, this change is not for you. You are going to continue to use PowerShell, because exactly, that's the way you do it. This change is for the vast bulk of Office 365 admins who belong and deal with very small tenants. And they're not full-time admins, and they don't have the time to learn PowerShell. They want to use an admin interface, which is simple, easy to use, and gets what they need to get done. So, in fact, part of the design philosophy that you see here, which is quite good, is that common tasks are surfaced.
Right.
They're right there in front of you. They're there to be used. So that's goodness. But I do think that Microsoft still has got some work to do in just speeding things up, getting rid of the bugs and adding all that functionality. But another point that I'd also make is that there is no effort going on, and Microsoft has been specific about it. There is no effort going on to rationalize the other admin experiences across Office 365. So
yes,
you've got the Compliance Center, EAC for Exchange Online, SharePoint Admin,
Skype
for Business, and Yammer.
Yep.
And they all look different. They all behave different. They have different design languages, and it's a bit of a mishmash.
In some ways, it's to be expected.
It is.
We mentioned earlier that if you're driving toward having a common code base for the service and on-prem, then either you have to accept that you're going to have different interfaces and then all the headaches that come from having a forked UI design, or you have to accept that the service is going to consume the same on-prem UI that on-prem customers see, at least until they figure out a way to take the service UI and make it palatable.
Well, there's the logic. There is the logic.
That's what I've been trying to do. But that's not a small
because project. If you think of Exchange 2013 or 2016 admin who's happy enough doing stuff on-prem through EAC, and they start to now connect up to Office 365, they see the same admin experience.
Exactly.
It wouldn't make a hell of a lot of sense at the moment to have a version of EAC that works on-prem and looks and behaves in a particular way, and then have a completely different, you know, different color schemes, different icons, different placement of options and stuff like that for cloud mailboxes. That just wouldn't make sense. So I can see the logic of maintaining a rough appearance and feature parity between the on-prem admin UIs and what you see for workload-specific UIs. Again, this is Exchange, SharePoint, etc. But it is also interesting to note that that Microsoft has an effort to start gathering together in the compliance center tasks that apply to multiple Office 365 workloads, and that has its own UI. So we are going to have this different set. You're going to have the new admin experience, you're going to have particular tasks that belong with compliance in the compliance center, and then you're going to have UIs for all the individual workloads. So it's in one way you can think of it, it's a bit of a mess, I guess, if you were coming to Office 365 out of the box and had never seen any of the on-premises applications, you would absolutely say it's a bit of a mess. But if you have come from a place where, and I believe this is the case for the vast bulk of tenants, that you've come from a place where you've seen an on-prem version of these apps, it's okay. It's absolutely okay. Planner.
So yeah, Planner. Speaking of things that are new.
Yep.
Planner finally exited preview and is a, you know, I think of it as a first class peer of all the other services because it's included in the app launcher, the Office Waffle. It's separately licensable and controllable to grant access to users in the same way that you would give someone an Exchange Online mailbox or grant them access to Yammer in your tenant. What do you think of it so far? I think it's got some interesting strengths and weaknesses compared to products such as Trello.
Well, Trello is obviously the target here.
Clearly.
If you do, and somebody has done a pretty good comparison of Trello versus Office 365.
I saw that earlier this week.
Yeah. You just have to look at the two applications side by side and you say, okay, well, there's some different naming conventions used, but essentially you're looking at Planner as being the Microsoft implementation of Trello as task-based management. Now, don't get me wrong here. There is a huge difference between the two, and that huge difference is the Office 365 infrastructure.
Exactly.
Because whereas Planner depends on a new Azure-based service to maintain the metadata about plans, the data storage and the communications capabilities are provided by Office 365, by Exchange Online and SharePoint Online in the form of an Office 365 group that provide the essential underpinning for every plan. So you have a one-to-one relationship between a plan and a group. You can't have multiple plans belonging to a single group, and you can't have multiple groups being associated with a single plan. It's a one-to-one relationship at the moment. Now, Planner is still not in preview. It's still not general availability. They're looking at general availability according to all the public mutterings that they've put out in Q2. So by the end of June, they'll be there. And at that stage, every Office 365 tenant will be able to spin off Office 365 groups and be able to spin up plans, and it'll all be good. We'll all be highly organized. I think that the interesting thing for me is the spectrum of task management that now exists. You know, you think of at the bottom end, you have user-specific tasks, highly personal things, and they're things that you would put into an app like Wunderlist or Outlook tasks, right? Then at the top end, you've got the highly structured, highly complex, but suitable to manage the biggest and the most complex projects that you care to put together. And that's Project Server or the on-premises right. project version. And the gap in the middle is really what Planner is all about. So it's not as sophisticated at all as Project, and that's to be expected because you don't want to take away sales from Project. On the other hand, it's a hell of a lot more sophisticated and a hell of a lot better for small teams than it would be to try and do something through Wunderlist or through Outlook tasks. So it does fill a gap.
It's interesting to see how those gaps are being filled and how these pieces plug together. So for example, there's a very good Wunderlist add-in for Outlook now.
Yes.
That allows you to select a message and either create an ad hoc task or just take the existing message yes. and turn it into a task with a single click. That multiplies the usefulness of Wunderlist right there.
Yeah, but Microsoft have gone on record by saying that Wunderlist integration with Planner is very much on the cards.
Oh, I would expect so.
They've actually been a lot less enthusiastic about having an integration between Outlook tasks.
There's a good reason for that. So at the MVP Summit, I had the opportunity to sit down with some folks from the Outlook team, and task management was one of the key topics that we discussed. And they made the very good point that Outlook has evolved to be a general purpose system for tracking tasks. And the way that you do it and the way that I do it and the way someone else does it may be completely different. You may follow the David Allen getting things done methodology and use Outlook as a way to do that. Mm-hmm. I may have just an unstructured methodology where when I remember to do something, I put it in as an Outlook task. So the Outlook team has sort of made a conscious decision not to meddle with the way Outlook manages tasks right now, because there is no one right way to do it.
Yeah, it's, I think, very Planner, personal.
Planner is a reaction to that. Planner is an attempt to provide a much more structured way for department or work group or project oriented tasks that are more structured than what you would typically put in Outlook. Hmm. I mean, Planner, as you said, is not really the place where you would write down that you need to make an appointment to take the cat to the vet or to pick up your dry cleaning. But I think that if you look at
You wanted to share those tasks with members of the group.
Well, I will say I use OneNote and its task management functionality very heavily with my kids, because for grocery lists and things like we want a common shared list base. It's not a to-do list in the sense that we don't need due dates and the other features that come with real task management. Mm. It's just a easy way for all of us to have one coordinated list to work on. So I suppose we should mention OneNote in that context too. There are certainly people who use it as a task management tool.
Absolutely. I mean, some people use just plain old Word documents and they have bulleted lists there.
Oh, the horror.
The horror, yes.
So there are many different ways to do this, and yes. Planner represents Microsoft's attempt to give people, I think, a standardized set of tools that is lighter weight and less expensive and more manageable than Project.
Yes, and if you know, there are changes that are going to come before general availability. I mean, they're talking about things like a mobile app. You know, another mobile app from Microsoft for that. So that's good. They'll probably smarten up the user interface. There have been some flaws that have been identified. Already, they have added things like checklists to tasks, which are quite good. And I expect they might have a look at some of the charts they've got, the chart gallery, if you will, that is available in Planner right now is pretty sparse. However, they have been clear at saying, you know, some of the sophisticated project management type charts, such as like Gantt charts, for example, are not going to appear in Planner because they're very much in the domain of something like Project.
You know, it's interesting because there's still one major gap that I think Microsoft would be well positioned to fill in this whole project and task management space. And they don't seem to have much interest in doing it. And that's assuming that I have a project coming up and I have a pool of resources that I could pick from. and I want to know in weeks out who's going to be available. You can do that within the context of a Microsoft project or project server plan if you've already identified and created the resources and assigned tasks to them. But in the common case where, say, you're a consultant and you say, okay, the customer wants to start a project in 4 weeks, who's available 4 weeks out? How do you know? You can look at their Outlook calendar, but Microsoft doesn't have a resource management system that will do that right now across any of these management products. So guys, if you're listening, you know, great opportunity for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that over the next couple of years, you'll see that the lines that are clearly defined at the moment will blur in a little. I think, for example, once you have all of your people on the on Office 365, there's nothing to stop you having a little service that's going to go and collect information about that, about people, and expose that to something like Planner. So we'll see. The point, though, at the end of the day, is that this is an interesting new application. It's been introduced. It's going to be available for all enterprise customers, so anybody with an e-plan, you're going to get it, and the equivalent academic, equivalent government plans. So it's going to be very widely used. And they are talking about a number of improvements that are coming along the line. So that's all good. Now, the integration with groups, of course, then creates some opportunities. It's given them out-of-the-box mailbox, calendar, and document support, which is good. But it's also given them some issues. One issue that comes up time and time again for Planner, which is directly related to groups, is the lack of support for external users.
Yes. Okay. And we see that as a recurring theme. We had the same problem when OneDrive was first introduced.
Yes.
That we still, I think, have the same problem in many respects where Yammer is concerned. There's some aspects of the service that just don't play well with people who are not on the service or who are in other tenants.
Yes. And to be fair here, the problem is that groups are a security mechanism insofar as once you become a member of a group, you get access to all of the resources of the group. It's not a very finely grained security access, if you want to look at it that way, because of the fact that everybody has exactly the same access to all of the resources of the group. But the problem, I think, that they have been grappling with for the last year, because that's how long they've been working on this, is how do you grant external access to a group in such a way that it's controllable? Because you may want, let's say in the context of Planner, you may want somebody to be an external member of a project team, right? But you may not want them to have full access to all of the documents that are stored in the document library of the group that underpins that plan.
So would you attack that by having two groups? An inner group and
no,
an outer group?
No, I think that the solution that you're going to see is that, I'm only speculating here. The solution that I suspect will come along is that you will have some method of defining an identity, an Office 365 identity for an external user. And that you will then be able to use that external identity, or that identity for the external user, to become a group member of a specific type. Now, already inside groups, there are three different types. There's owners, there's members, and there's subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
So what's to stop them saying, well, we're going to have an external type? I'm just speculating here. But in any case, once they have solved the problems for how to provide external access to groups, then that will flow through into Planner, because Planner depends on groups for its authorization at the end of the day.
Well, let's talk more broadly about groups. You know, this has been an area where Microsoft has really invested heavily, maybe more heavily than in a lot of other areas of the service, to try to deploy some of the features that we have previously had in other combinations of public folders and SharePoint document libraries and shared mailboxes, team mailboxes, etc. So what's the latest on groups? What has Microsoft done most recently?
Well, all I hear is that groups are extremely popular with tenants, absolutely extremely popular. However, there have been a number of long-standing requests that are proving to be deployment blockers that Microsoft know about and are working very hard to fix. When you think about it, they started off groups with just one client, that was Outlook Web App. They have done well in terms of expanding the client base to have a mobile client, but more particularly to have Outlook support, because that, you know, so many people, Outlook is still the biggest client for Office 365. So having group support now in Outlook 2016 was really, really important. But then you have these other blockers that have come into play, and I've written down a few here that I hear time after time. Clearly, external access, that's a big thing. People who are external to an Office 365 tenant can participate in Office 365 groups, but they can only participate on the basis of emailed contributions to conversations. They can't have access to the group document library, they can't have access to the notebook or anything else like a plan. So that's a big thing, and that needs to be solved. And as we talked about just a few moments ago, I think there's a basis for a solution coming into focus. The next thing that I hear time and time again is the inability to change the group type. By default, groups are declared to be public. They're defined as public when you create them. And this is part of the philosophy behind groups, that Microsoft wanted to create sharing entities that users could drive, that IT was not going to control. So therefore, anybody could create a group, the group was public, and anybody could join the group, and it was happy to slide.
And we heard some pushback from that, because there are some organizations where they don't want users to willy-nilly, like back in the original days of public folders.
Yeah, public folders are the classic example of where users create resources without constraint. It can end up in what can only be described as a spaghetti mess. Now, part of the reasons why people get worried about this kind of stuff is that they worry about resource. But in fact, that doesn't really apply to groups, because all of the resource is being provided by Microsoft.
That's on Microsoft's tab.
But still, organizations do like, especially in the educational sector. I mean, you don't want every school kid having the ability to create groups. That would just be bad. So there is a demand for the ability to switch groups between public and private, or private to public. The difference there is that if a group is public, anybody can join it. If it's private, then you can only be joined by an administrator. So that's good. The next thing I've heard is that a need exists for a soft delete function. Because today, if you go and delete a group, or indeed if you go and delete a group as part of a plan, okay, that's a hard delete.
Right.
That's bye-bye. Bye-bye group mailbox, bye-bye group calendar, bye-bye group notebook, and bye-bye document library. There's no concept of being able to say, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
That could be an expensive mistake.
That could be a job-limiting mistake. So definitely some sort of ability to soft delete a group is required. Compliance is a big issue. There is progress being made in terms of being able to execute discovery searches against the contents of group mailboxes, but there's still a problem in resolving how the Search Foundation can gain access to the files in group document libraries. And a lot of this comes about the whole access model that's being used, and because the Search Foundation can't get access to it, can't index it, and whatever, you then end up with important features such as e-discovery searches not really being able to work. And this is specifically for groups that are marked as private, because if they're public, anybody can get them. Okay, but you also end up with things like Delve not surfacing things. So there's a whole sort of issues there that need to be resolved and better. And then lifecycle management, just the aging out of groups that are created that nobody ever uses. And I know Microsoft is working on this. And, this all sounds as though I'm being terribly critical. I'm absolutely not, because there's been a lot of changes. There have been a lot of improvements in groups over the last year. I particularly like the new way that they're using for browsing groups. In the past, it was a case of, browse groups, and you'd see this picture of groups, and you'd have to scroll up and down. It worked terribly well for a demo environment where you had less than 100 groups. Once you have 20,000 groups, it doesn't work so good. So what they're now using is a Discover feature, where basically they use information recorded in the Microsoft Graph about your interests and people that you collaborate with and the people you share information with to suggest groups to you. Now, you can still go and browse the entire collection of groups if you want.
So now it's like Facebook at work, basically.
Groups, yeah, exactly.
Where you suggest that
it there suggests are that groups these that things that you might want to do. So I like that. And then the last thing I'll say is that you've got Microsoft has been promising that there would be some sort of connection between groups and Yammer. There is a tension between groups and Yammer. People who come from an email centric view of the world when it comes to collaboration, I think find groups very, very natural because they're used to driving everything through email.
Right.
And especially now that Outlook supports groups. So that's fantastic. But on the other hand, if you're one of the organizations that bought into Yammer and like its way of enabling collaboration and sharing of ideas and so forth and so on, then you're a little bit frustrated because you're completely cut off from this other way of collaboration. And that other way of collaboration, by the way, has got things like shared calendars, document libraries, etc., that you may want to use. So clearly, Microsoft had this yawning gap between groups and Yammer, and they need to close it. And I have been hearing for probably 9 months, yes, we're going to do it. It seems that something is going to be done before the end of Q2. But let's wait and see what that is.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because, of course, another big change in the service is that now it's all Yammer all the time. Yammer is available to all tenants. And there's something extra special about it in that it's now enabled for all users by default.
Yeah, but being enabled doesn't mean you have to use it. Again, I think... I think, you know, Yammer raises tension and blood pressure in some. And it raises a great deal of ecstasy in others. It depends on how you view the way to do collaboration. To me, Yammer is a tool, it's a collaboration tool that works well in certain contexts. It works extremely well, as I said earlier on, as the foundation for Microsoft's Office 365 IT network, where you've got 80,000 people from all around the world, all different organizations, collaborating and sharing ideas, solving problems. Fantastic. And email is not good at that kind of thing.
No, it's not.
It absolutely is not good. However, will Yammer replace email? I don't think so. Because Yammer is weak in compliance. It's weak in encryption. It's weak in information rights management. It's weak in all of these features and functionality that have been built into email over the years. But it has its place. And really, the fact that Microsoft has enabled Yammer for all Office 365 tenants it's maybe making the onboarding of Yammer a little bit easier in some cases. You don't have to go and ask for it be enabled and all the rest of it. But is it going to make much difference? I don't know. I think the organizations that like Yammer will use it regardless. And the organizations that like email will use it regardless.
I think that's probably true. It's interesting to go back and look at the various features that Microsoft has turned on by default or turned off by default when they introduced them. For example, when they released Skype Meeting Broadcast.
Yes.
That feature is available to every user by default, but it's turned off in the tenant. So before anybody in the org can schedule a broadcast meeting, you have to enable it for the tenant. But the minute you do that, everyone who has a Skype license, either through an enterprise plan or through an individual Skype license, has access to it.
You were a big Skype guy in the past. I mean, you did a lot more Skype than you probably do now. Well, I'm curious, what do you think Microsoft has got a shot of replacing PBXs and all the rest of it now with all these enterprise features that they bundle into the E5 plan?
They bundle it into
E5. And available as add-ons. I mean,
I've been using the Cloud PBX and PSTN calling and the conferencing features for, close to 6 months now, and I love them.
Yes.
They work very, very well for my particular needs. But I'm coming from an environment where I'm highly mobile.
Yes.
I don't have a centralized PBX. You know, I didn't have one at my previous employer. I don't have one here at eNow. I don't want one. Mm-hmm. Because to me, you know, telephony is almost a utility service. I don't want to have my own generator to run the lights in my place of business. I want to be able to plug a laptop into the wall and have it be powered. So from that standpoint, in terms of it having a very light deployment footprint and working very well, mm-hmm. and not requiring the same level of knowledge and skill that an on-prem deployment would, I'm very happy with it. It's an open question to see whether bigger organizations are going to be able to use it, because it's still relatively early in the life cycle. So for example, Microsoft very recently, today in fact, mentioned that they were going to be releasing the cloud connector for PSTN calling and cloud PBX. It's essentially an all-in-one VM mm-hmm. that you put on your network that makes sure that your on-prem link, I think Link 2010 is supported, but I would have to check. Certainly Link 2013 and Skype on-prem have all the roles and pieces that they need to be able to connect to the cloud so that you can have a true hybrid enterprise voice deployment, even if you have on-prem EV or an on-prem PBX. One of the things that a lot of people don't recognize about PBXs and telephony in general is there's an awful lot of infrastructure and there's an awful lot of very specialized knowledge that most people never see. You pick up the phone, you dial a number, everything just works. But a lot of work has to happen before that's possible. Mm-hmm. So for organizations that have PBXs, especially expensive, I'm not naming any names, Cisco, but if they have existing expensive IP PBXs, it's going to be hard to justify replacing those with a cloud solution until the normal refresh pattern. Mm-hmm. For organizations that don't have a current PBX or that have one that they're replacing anyway, I think the 365 Skype feature set is pretty compelling.
Do you think they've got the pricing right?
Well, it's hard to say because it depends on what pricing you're talking about.
Well, I'm talking about where you throw in all the calling plans and stuff.
Right, but what I mean is maybe you get it because you buy E5. And then in that case, the discussion really turns to one of, do you need all the things that are included in E5? Do you need Equivio? Do you need Delve Analytics? Do you need the other things that are included? Mm-hmm. Or do you need an E3 license or maybe even a lower level with some add-ons? And then the discussion becomes one of, okay, what do these add-ons cost relative to what it would cost me to deliver those services on their own? Mm-hmm. I think for what you get, the pricing is pretty compelling. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I think it's on the order of $8 per user per month for the conferencing features, which are well worth it when you compare the overhead to having something like GoToMeeting or WebEx for group meetings. They work very well. The telephony support is brilliant. You just dial a phone number and you get joined to the conference. And there's no infrastructure to manage. So, from that standpoint, I think that's a slam dunk. Hmm. The calling features, I suppose it depends on how many calls you make and where you make them and how broadly your tenants are distributed. Those features are still not available in all the markets where 365 is available. And so I think there are some places where telephony costs are higher than they are, for example, in North America and the western part of Europe, where those services would be very welcome if Microsoft were able to deploy them broadly.
You mentioned Delve Analytics there as part of the E5 plan. I've been spending quite a lot of time with Delve Analytics.
Yes, you have. That's what Delve Analytics told me.
Yes. It's kind of interesting. I mean, when we were at the MVP Summit in November in Redmond, we had the opportunity of chatting with some of those guys, and that started me off on a path to really understand what was going on. I guess the path started actually well before that, when Julie White got up at the Ignite event, the opening keynote, and exposed Delve Analytics for the first time with a vision of something that would help you control your personal work-life balance and all the rest of it. And it was interesting to see what would actually come about when something was productized. I guess my summary of it is that I think it's an incomplete work in progress. And the reason why I say that is this. Firstly, it only covers email.
Right.
Okay. And it is an incomplete coverage of email, because really, if you have a lot of the email that you process goes outside of the organization, you're going to miss value, because it can't tell. Delve naturally can't. Delve Analytics naturally can't gather data about your interaction with people outside the organization. For example, if I send, because we're in different Office 365 tenants, when I send mail to you, Dev Analytics stops tracking at the boundary of my tenant.
Right.
So, you know, that's one of the things. But anyway,
can you imagine if Microsoft tracked across tenancy?
Don't get me wrong here. I think that's totally understandable. And it's actually a pointer that Dell Analytics is going to be a lot more useful for very large organizations. In fact, as I said in a piece I wrote on it, Microsoft is exactly the kind of organization that Dell Analytics is designed for. You know, funny that. But so the first thing is that it's incomplete. It's email only, and some of the algorithms that they're using are really quite crude. For example, you know, every message that you read, well, that's 2.5 minutes. It doesn't take me 2.5 minutes to read messages. Every message you create takes 5 minutes. And again, some of my mail takes a lot less than five. But these are values that Microsoft has assessed and calculated based on an awful lot of research. So they're probably good enough. I think the biggest issue I've got with it is that because it's only email, really, and I take calendar as part of the email because it's all mailbox data.
Sure.
It is going to create, by its very nature, an incomplete picture of somebody's work. As I spend a lot of time writing during the week. I spend a lot of time writing. I store those documents in either OneDrive for Business, OneDrive Personal, or SharePoint. None of that activity is ever recorded. So, you know, Dell Analytics, I'm looking at it right now here, told me that last week I had 43 hours of focus hours, which means that I had 43 hours of unbroken time in my calendar where I wasn't doing anything. I would submit that I was probably pretty busy in those 43 hours. But because I'm probably spending an awful lot of that time you know, busy writing stuff, and it's just not captured.
But you can see that if you're a typical Microsoft program manager, for example, whose day is just, you know, littered with calendar invitations, it would be very useful to know when you had blocks of productive time.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I love this stuff. I love analytics. I love the idea of being able to understand things better than or understand data so I can make changes. It's just that that's why I say this is a work in progress. It's somewhat crude and it's somewhat incomplete, and it's a work in progress. And it will make much, much more sense for people who work in large organizations where email is the predominant way of collaboration. You know, there's nothing here about Yammer.
Right.
There's nothing here about Skype. But there's lots of stuff about email and lots of stuff about...
So do you suppose that's because Microsoft, across the service and in their own internal use, do you suppose it's because they value email more highly, or because it was easier to gather that data?
It's much easier to gather the data. It's important to say that when you come to Dell Analytics data, and people have expressed some fears about this, they very naturally imagine that this is a bit like Big Brother is looking over your shoulder, or the old time and motion studies where people were walking around with a clipboard and a stopwatch. It's not like that. All of the data that they're actually exposing here is available to users. If you took the time to go and look at all your mail headers, you could figure out how much time you spent creating and sending mail. In the same way, if you spent your time going and looking at your calendar, you could figure out how much time you spend in meetings every week. But you know what? You'd do this exercise once, because that type of stuff is mundane and tiresome.
True.
Right? Whereas computers are very good at automating the collection of tiresome and mundane data and making sense of it. And that's what Dell Analytics does.
Well, and when you talk about collecting that data, there's a lot of value at the organizational level to be able to see what the average employee does.
Yep.
Right? So if you know that on average your employees are taking a certain amount of time to create email, or that they on average have a limited amount of focus time, or on average that they're working to answer email outside of working hours, those are all very useful things to know.
Absolutely. And again, when you're talking about comparing to company data, it's important to say that all of the data that's used for those type of comparisons is anonymized. Okay, that's the first point. And the second point is that all of that data comes from people who opt in. You have to opt in to have your data very included in that data, in those calculations. So, for example, you may want to have a set of users, let's say in the law department, who absolutely do not want any of their information being used for general company comparisons, even though, you know, on an intellectual level, you can say, hey, this is going to harm you in any way. But they may, just from a gut feel and because their lawyers say, no, hell no, you're not going to do it. As it happens, it's very easy. There's a there's a PowerShell commandlet to allow you to control who's opting in for Delve Analytics and who's opting out. So overall, I'm very positive about it. I think it's the start of a journey. It was one of the most interesting articles I ever wrote, I think, because of just thinking about how this data is used and what it means and how it could be valuable. I ended up actually, when I finished, I ended up with an article that was about 9,500 words, which of course, that's stupid. You can't publish an article of 9,500 words. People wouldn't read it. So what's actually online is about 4,000 words. So that's just, you know, and what I'm saying, I guess there's another 5,500 words of explanations, feelings, ideas about what the data, there's a lot behind this stuff. So that, it's one of the more interesting parts of Office 365, that's for sure. Now, I did have one thing that we passed by when we're talking about groups that I just want to cover before we go to our last topic, is the cost of dynamic groups, because that came up recently. Microsoft has enabled support for dynamic Office 365 groups, but, and this is great, because it allows you to think about your dynamic distribution groups and say, well, I've got a place that they can go and, you know, take advantage of Office 365 groups. The little detail that's there is that Office 365 dynamic groups are an Azure AD premium feature.
And I'm sure that was intentional.
Well, whether it's, this may not be an issue for some companies, because some companies may want to use Azure AD for premium for other.
Right, or they may have bought EMS. Right. They may already have it. That's true.
They may have it. So that's just fine. But for companies that haven't, this could be a significant expense, especially when the rules of the game are as follows. Any user that's covered by any rule or any query against the directory included in a group has to have an Azure AD premium license, $6 a month per user. So it is conceivable that an administrator, through no fault of their own, comes up with a bad query. And the bad query means that all users in the tenant
are included
in a query for one way or another. Yeah, the rules of the game are immediately those guys are all liable to $6 a month.
So, is there a grace period? Suppose you create a bad query and then you notice it the next day and turn it off. Is Microsoft going to send you a bill?
Or well, as it happens, work? Microsoft does not enforce the restriction.
Well, that, you know, if I were talking but to it's lawyers, a licensing, say, no, it's a licensing.
It's a licensing violation. But if that's even scarier, in fact, I wouldn't mind if they impose the restriction right there, because then that's an then error condition. You know. But what could happen is that you go and create your query and it's fine and you've got this wonderful list and everything's happy and, you know, we can all sing Kumbaya and get on with life. And then Microsoft decides to enforce the restriction and all of a sudden your groups don't work anymore. So it's an area I think that Microsoft needs to look at. I would very much welcome if they said, for example, that they would make it, they would take it away from Azure AD Premium and include it in some of the enterprise Office 365 plans.
And we've seen them do similar things with, for example, multi-factor authentication. It's not a good question.
Right. So that's just a thing I wanted to mention. It's a heads up for people that if you're interested in dynamic Office 365 groups, by all means, go for it. It's a great piece of functionality, but be aware that you are taking on the burden of Azure AD premium licenses, unless, of course, you already have them, in which case, happiness and life, move on. So last topic for today is training.
I'm in favor.
You're in favor, which is good. But really, this came about through an article. It was really a reader query that came into WindowsITPro.com to say, well, you know what, I'm an experienced Exchange admin. I really am. I've been doing this work for years and I want to advance my skills. And I've looked out there in the market and you know what? Microsoft has got rid of the MCM, the architect training, or the certified master training. And nobody really seems to be doing advanced Exchange training anymore. What's the scene? Now, we've been down this path before because we we ran Exchange 2010 Maestro training.
We did. It was commercially successful. It got great reviews from the attendees. It was a lot of work to put together and manage just from a logistical standpoint because we did it in multiple cities. And the overhead of finding people and coordinating the classes and running the labs and so forth was pretty significant. But at the end of the day, it was unique at the time because it was a bridge, if you will, between the low-level Microsoft official curriculum courses and then the capstone of the Microsoft Certified Master Program. Right. Now that MCM's gone and there is no capstone, I think your reader's absolutely right. There's a huge gap between what you can get at your local New Horizons or what you can teach yourself from watching, say, Microsoft Virtual Academy videos and the kind of very focused high-end training that people are accustomed to for complex workloads like Exchange or, you know, to put it in perspective from another manufacturer. If you look at the kind of training that's available for Cisco certifications or for Cisco's products, that spans the gamut from entry-level training all the way up to extremely difficult, complex, time-consuming capstone courses.
Right.
And I think there's a big hole in the top of that market for all the Office 365 workloads, not just Exchange.
Yeah, it is strange. It's a problem today. I think the move to the cloud has had a dramatic effect on the training that's available for the on-premises community, and there isn't any great, really advanced training available out there for Office 365.
There's not. I get that question a lot because as a consultant, when I go out and talk to organizations that are thinking about deploying 365, you know, Jay, our CEO at eNow, has made a great point, which is that in the world we live in now, a lot of the times the decision to move to the cloud is driven from the top down.
Yes.
For various reasons, some good, some bad, that decision comes down from on high. It's not a grassroots upward decision. And when that happens, naturally, people who are administering on-prem workloads get skittish and they worry about their job. I hear that a lot. We've been hearing that for a long time. You know, it's been a common topic of discussion at Connections and Microsoft's various conferences. So I actually have an article in Windows IT Pro that I think should be published now, or if not now, shortly, called Becoming a Cloud Pro, that starts to address how do you go from making the transition to being a skilled on-premises admin to a skilled cloud admin? Because the cloud doesn't necessarily take away work, it redistributes it.
Azure AD, just different.
Well, it is. Azure AD Premium is a great example. If you know how to administer on-premises Active Directory, then the concepts of what a user object is, what a contact is, or the difference between a dynamic group and a static group, those concepts are still the same, but the buttons you push and the things you do are different. So that's one area of learning, but most of that is relatively low level. The big gap in skills comes from understanding the things that you can do or must do in a cloud world that don't have on-prem equivalents. How do you manage Office 365 groups? Well, you're never going to learn that from an on-prem-oriented training curriculum because it doesn't cover that functionality. And as you say, Microsoft hasn't addressed that, nor has the third-party market, by creating content that covers the equivalent level of knowledge that you would want to move from a skilled Exchange administrator position or a Skype or SharePoint administrator to the corresponding skill level in the cloud. And that's a problem.
Yeah, it is a problem. I don't think we're going to share it. Solved that particular one today, so maybe on that depressing note, we should probably call it a day and let our listeners
go. I hate to end on a depressing note, so let me just point out that at least in the Northern Hemisphere, spring is approaching fast, so everyone can hopefully take some comfort from that.
Yeah, okay. Well, on that note of the weather.
See, that's a happy note.
Yeah, happy note. Paul's happy. So thanks very much for listening, and we say goodbye, and we talk to you again on the next podcast when we don't know when that will be.
Who knows?
Who knows, but it'll be soon.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, Paul.